Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A stage act so bad, it's good.
Was an American Idol of the 1890s.
A controversial movie that sparked a riot.
Protesters are shouting, police are trying to clear the lobby.
And the invasion of the giant snails.
It was like a scene from a horror movie, like zombies coming up out of the grave.
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics, tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum. Alamogordo, New Mexico. The town's barren landscape famously provided the backdrop for one of history's most seismic events, the first successful detonation of an atomic bomb in 1945. Chronicling other strides in 20th century technology is the New Mexico Museum of Space History. Its exhibits include a rocket-powered sled, a radio-controlled World War II missile called the Gargoyle, and a bust of John Paul Stapp, a physicist once dubbed the fastest man alive for breaking the world's land speed record. But amidst these objects forged in metal is a woven item held together by rope and thread.
The artifact is about a foot and a half long, and it has some cream-colored cloth as well as some darker tan cloth. And it was designed to go into one of the harshest environments imaginable.
According to museum representative Michael Shinneberry, suits like this were worn by a group of unlikely heroes, trained dogs.
Without their brave contribution, mankind may never have made it into space.
How did man's best friend set the stage for a giant leap? 1957, the USSR. With the launch of Sputnik, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, the Soviet Union has taken a decisive lead against the United States in the space race. Now, they plan to up the ante.
They were going to launch the first living creature into space.
Uncertain how humans will respond to the weightless environment of space, Soviet scientists decide to see how another species will fare first. Dogs.
Dogs could sit for long periods of time. They could be taught to be still, to be quiet, and dogs were very easy to train that way.
But not just any dogs will do. Scientists need animals who can survive the frigid temperatures of orbit, and some of the hardiest dogs in the Soviet Union are the strays living on the streets in Moscow.
Those particular dogs endured cold, and it gets cold in Moscow, so they were used to the cold that they would have to endure in space. So they went and picked animals right off the street.
After a month of searching, engineers find the ideal candidate. A female mutt they call Laika. Russian for Barker.
Laika was a very likable pup. She was photogenic, very cute little animal. Her temperament was very good, and she performed well in all of the training that she went through.
Then, just a week after picking her up off the street, scientists bundle Laika into a cloth spacesuit and settle her in to the Sputnik 2.
They all surrounded her, they all kissed her nose, they all wished her bon voyage.
On November 3rd, 1957, Sputnik 2 lifts off. Moments later, the spacecraft exits the atmosphere, and Laika enters the history books as the first living creature to reach orbit. Mission Control receives a steady stream of transmissions measuring Laika's vital signs, and the Soviet space team is thrilled to see they're holding steady, yet the euphoria is short-lived. A technical malfunction causes the heating system inside her module to break down.
The capsule began to overheat. Temperature went up to 104 degrees.
Scientists watch helplessly as Laika's vital signs fail.
She did not get that far into the flight. She died within a few hours later.
Yet Laika's mission emboldens Soviet scientists to set the bar higher. Now that they've launched an animal into space, they must figure out how to bring one back alive. The team immediately begins planning a follow-up mission with an improved capsule. And this time, instead of selecting just one stray, they choose two. Their names are Belka and Strelka.
Belka and Strelka were taken off the streets of Moscow. They were trained, and they were just lovable little animals.
Soviet scientists outfit the space capsule with a live camera so they can better monitor the pups during the mission. Finally, on August 19, 1960, Belka and Strelka are fastened into their module. At 3:44 p.m., Sputnik 5 lifts off the launch pad. As it hurtles into space, scientists nervously study the images beamed down to Mission Control. And what they see is discouraging. The dogs lie utterly motionless.
The scientists thought that these dogs had had a seizure, and the seizure had led to their deaths.
Have the Russians just sent two more dogs to their doom? For 90 minutes, scientists gaze at the camera feed, hoping for signs of life. But Belka and Strelka remain eerily still. But then, an unsavory incident offers the anxious scientists some encouragement.
One of the dogs shuddered all of a sudden, and then promptly threw up.
The dog's inactivity was due to motion sickness.
Pretty much for the rest of the mission, they were active. And there really weren't any detrimental negative side effects that the dogs seemed to be exhibiting.
Belka and Strelka complete 18 orbits of the Earth before they finally touch back down in the Soviet Union, 25 hours after their mission began.
They were national heroes. They were darlings. Their pictures appeared on postcards, on postage stamps.
And their triumph spurs the Soviets on to the next phase of space exploration.
Not long after that, Yuri Gagarin was lifted off from the planet Earth to become the first man in space.
Today, the spacesuit at the New Mexico Museum of Space History recalls the canine cosmonauts that paved the way for man's quest to reach for the stars. London boasts some of the United Kingdom's most beautiful architecture, such as Buckingham Palace, St. Paul's Cathedral, and the Houses of Parliament. And in the heart of this thriving metropolis is the Museum of London, which charts the city's cultural and archaeological history. Its collection includes the 5,000-year-old remains of a Neolithic woman, an Iron Age dagger, and mugs from the 1661 coronation of King Charles II. And amidst these treasures is one that evokes vivid memories of the Victorian period.
It's 7 feet high, 13 and a half feet long. It's black, made of wood, leather, and glass.
This is a 19th century hansom cab. These elegant carriages were vehicles for hire that ferried passengers around English cities. But according to author Angela Buckley, one such cab was associated with a horrific crime and a legendary crime fighter.
He was a detective whose flair for deduction connects him with one of the most famous characters in literary fiction.
Who was this super sleuth? And what legendary literary figure was he said to inspire? 1889, Manchester, England. High crime and rampant violence plague the people of the city. And the night of February 26th proves to be no exception, when a respected businessman named John Fletcher is found dead in the back of a hansom cab. His valuables are missing, but strangely, there's not a mark on him.
This was an extremely puzzling case.
The man charged with solving the crime is Detective Chief Inspector Jerome Caminada.
Jerome Caminada grew up in the slums himself, so he had an intimate knowledge of all the characters and shady people around him.
Over his 20 years on the force, Caminada has developed an extensive network of informants and a knack for logic and deduction.
His methods were highly effective, and in fact, they led to him gaining the reputation of the city's finest police officer.
But this case is about to challenge even Caminada's seasoned skills. Caminada starts by interviewing the driver of the hansom cab. The hack tells Caminada that he had picked up Fletcher and another man from a local pub. But halfway through the journey, he turned around and discovered that Fletcher was dead, and the other passenger had vanished. The driver describes the unknown companion as short, clean-shaven, and wearing a dark brown suit.
But there was very little more than that to go on.
But then, Detective Caminada gets a crucial break. He learns that traces of a chemical called chloral hydrate have been found in the victim's system.
The drug is a vital clue, and Detective Caminada realized that the drug, chloral hydrate, was often used in illegal prize fighting in the drinking dens in the city.
Slipped to an opponent, it provided boxers with a secret advantage in any fight.
Obviously, that would slow them down. Then they would rig the betting against them. And so he deduced that the suspect in this case was linked to illegal prize fighting.
So how will Caminada identify the assailant?
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's 1889. Jerome Caminada is an accomplished detective, skilled in the powers of deduction and observation. But now he's facing one of his toughest cases ever, solving the murder of a local businessman, John Fletcher, who appears to have been killed with a lethal sedative used to fix illegal boxing matches. So can Caminada crack this complicated case?
The cunning detective scours the underground boxing scene for suspects. His investigation leads him to a man who fits the description of Fletcher's mystery companion, and who also has a direct connection to rigged fights.
He came up with the prime suspect, 18-year-old Charlie Parton, who was the son of a beer housekeeper who used the drug chloral hydrate to drug opponents in the ring.
Caminata wastes no time and arrests the man. Parton later admits to drugging Fletcher in order to rob him. And with his suspect convicted of murder and sentenced to life behind bars, Detective Caminata is hailed as a hero.
The case was very widely reported in the national press, and Jerome Caminata became a household name, not just in Manchester, but throughout the country. The case became known more formally as the Manchester Cab Mystery, and it became his signature case.
By the time of his death in 1914, the clever crime fighter is credited with bringing over 1,000 criminals to justice. But his story doesn't end there. In 2012, author Angela Buckley is conducting research for a book on Jerome Caminata when she starts to notice similarities with another, albeit fictional, sleuth, Sherlock Holmes.
They both had excellent powers of deduction. They both had their network of informants. And they both smoked a pipe, actually.
According to Buckley, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous author of the Sherlock Holmes series, was certainly aware of the real-life lawman.
Detective Caminata was at the very height of his career in the 1880s, just the time when Sherlock Holmes made his debut. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would have read about his cases very widely in the press.
Today, this two-wheeled hansom cab at the Museum of London stands as a reminder of a real-life super sleuth and the iconic detective he may have inspired. Miami, Florida is known for its blue skies and temperate climate. But it is also subject to some of the most extreme weather in the United States. Since 1871, this city has withstood more than 70 hurricanes. Exploring this stormy history is the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science. Its collection includes a P3 Hurricane Hunter cockpit, radar equipment from a National Storm Center, and a tattered American flag damaged during Hurricane Andrew in 1992. But one object here recalls an entirely different kind of natural disaster.
It's brown, about 5 inches long, with a curved shape that's twisted. The surface is cracked and shiny.
This artifact may look like a beachcomber's treasure. But according to writer Craig Pittman, it once contained an unstoppable menace that nearly devoured South Florida.
This thing could star in its own horror movie. It left a stinky trail of destruction, and state officials virtually powerless to stop it.
What ravenous creature occupied this shell? Miami, Florida, spring 2011. Sisters Aida and Zoila Gutierrez are relaxing outside their home in a peaceful corner of the city, when their serenity is suddenly shattered.
The two sisters noticed the grass moving in their backyard, and as they got closer, they realized what they were looking at, a gigantic snail.
The horrified sisters soon realized that their entire backyard is infested with slimy monsters, some of which are the size of rats.
The snails were about 6 inches long, and they were all over the place.
And that isn't the only thing the sisters notice.
The smell of their mucus was something that just was staggering.
Appalled by these grotesque critters, the women reach out to Florida's Department of Agriculture to investigate. And when state inspectors arrive, they make a shocking discovery.
They realized this was not the average infestation of snails. This was something a little frightening. They were giant African land snails.
Giant African land snails are a type of mollusk native to East Africa. Though seemingly harmless, this sluggish beast is among the world's most destructive invasive species.
They eat 500 different kinds of plants. They have been known to even eat the stucco off the sides of houses.
But eating isn't the only thing they have an appetite for.
They reproduce very rapidly, and each snail could lay up to 500 eggs two or three times a year.
News of the invasion reaches city officials. They're baffled as to how the exotic animals got to America. But that's the least of their worries. Florida is the second largest producer of vegetables in the nation. If the pernicious pests escape the Miami city limits and infiltrate the farms to the north, they will cause widespread devastation.
They had to put a stop to it before it laid waste to the entire agricultural industry.
The Florida Department of Agriculture immediately dispatches a team of snail hunters to wipe out the population. They try everything from trapping the creatures to poisoning them. But no matter what they do, the epidemic keeps spreading. And it's not long before officials realize that their method of snail warfare may be deeply flawed. Experts inform them that after hatching, juvenile snails bury themselves underground for weeks before emerging to the surface to feed. The city of Miami could be teeming with an invisible enemy lying directly beneath its feet.
It was like a scene from a horror movie, like zombies coming up out of the grave. If they didn't find a way to stop this thing, the situation could spiral out of control.
With thousands of baby snails popping out of the ground every week, officials need a new approach. So they decide to use one of the pest's most unsavory characteristics to their advantage.
The Department of Agriculture decided that the snail's one weakness was their smell, their awful odor. They thought there might be a way to exploit that as a way to find them.
So officials introduced the unmistakable stench to a group of highly trained hunters, Labrador Retrievers.
Dogs are well known for being used to sniff out drugs. Why not use them to track down stinky snails?
It doesn't take long for the new approach to pay off. The canine detection team soon uncovers hundreds of subterranean snails across the city, including one that lived in the shell now on display at the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science. As Miami's snail population is gradually contained, one question remains. How did these diabolical monsters get from Africa to Florida in the first place?
An investigation found that the snails may have been smuggled from Africa into Miami.
It's believed a fringe Florida religious group performed African voodoo rituals using the odious creatures.
Their mucus was squeezed out, and people in this particular church would drink the mucus as part of a ritual. They thought the mucus would provide them with all sorts of religious benefits and physical benefits as well.
The leader of the sect allegedly stored the snails in his backyard, in the very same neighborhood where the pests were first discovered. Today, the seemingly unstoppable snail invasion appears to have slowed to a crawl.
There are still giant African land snails in Miami, but thanks to the dogs, they've made a major dent in the population.
And this specimen at the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum of Science stands as a chilling reminder of the fierce invaders who once seemed destined to lay waste to the state of Florida. The New York neighborhood of Astoria, Queens, was named in 1839 after John Jacob Astor, America's first multimillionaire. In the 20th century, the area became a center of film and television production. And perhaps no institution celebrates this legacy better than the Museum of the Moving Image. Its collection includes makeup and prosthetics from the 1970 film Little Big Man, starring Dustin Hoffman, a 1948 television, and a three-lens projector from the 1870s. But among these vestiges of cinematic history is an object that's anything but Technicolor.
It's about 10 inches high and 8 inches across. It's bound together by a bright blue string. It's made out of vanilla paper that's darkened and brittled with age.
As author Dick Lehr attests, this simple booklet is linked to one of America's earliest and most controversial films.
It was Hollywood's first blockbuster, but throughout is a message of hate.
What was this incendiary moving picture? And what extraordinary lengths were taken to stop it? April 1915. Visionary film director D.W. Griffith releases his latest work, The Birth of a Nation, in theaters in New York and Los Angeles. The three-hour epic dramatizes the Civil War and Reconstruction. Critics hail its unique camera work and visual complexity.
It was a breakthrough piece of work and did things that hadn't been done before. The battle scenes are panoramic and huge. No one had ever seen action like that before.
But not everyone's enthralled by this monumental piece of cinema. The film infuriates African Americans, who take issue with its racist imagery and depiction of the Ku Klux Klan as beneficial saviors.
Griffith portrays blacks as predators and the Klan as a kind of a healing force that begins to heal a divided nation and a birth of a nation. It's pretty crazy stuff.
Now, with the birth of a nation set to open in Boston, Massachusetts, one man vows to stop it. A 40-year-old newspaper publisher named William Monroe Trotter.
Trotter did not want this movie to go around the country unanswered.
Trotter schedules a meeting with Boston Mayor James Curley, hoping he'll heed his request to ban the racist film. But when Trotter arrives at City Hall on April 7th, he gets a huge shock. It seems that the movie's director has also been invited.
D.W. Griffith was come to town to defend his movie. He insisted that the film was historically accurate and was not libelous to blacks.
In the end, the mayor sees no reason to ban the film. And on April 10th, The Birth of a Nation is shown at Boston's Tremont Theater. There, theatergoers are given printed souvenir books, just like this one at the Museum of the Moving Image. But Trotter's fight isn't over yet.
Trotter was angry about it. He was not going to sit still after Mayor Curley's ruling.
To stop further screenings, Trotter and his comrades decide to buy tickets and stage a protest right in the theater's lobby. On April 17th, Trotter sets his plan into motion.
Trotter came across Boston Common. The crowd is swelling behind him.
But when they reach the theater, it seems the managers have gotten wind of Trotter's protest and instructed employees not to sell tickets to African Americans.
When they wouldn't let him buy the tickets, that just fueled that fire in Trotter's belly.
Outraged, Trotter refuses to leave the lobby. So the theater's manager decides to remove Trotter and his group by force.
Suddenly, uniformed police are coming down from around the corner, and you have a real confrontation. Trotter shouting, other protesters are shouting, police are trying to clear the lobby.
Trotter is arrested and jailed, along with his fellow demonstrators. And as the theater continues to show the film, it seems as though Trotter's audacious stunt has failed. But the next day, news of his demonstration makes headlines around the nation. Trotter's protest shines a harsh spotlight on the birth of a nation.
In certain cities, they were able to get Griffith to trim or cut some of the most extremely offensive moments in the film.
Trotter dies in 1934, and even though he never managed to ban The Birth of a Nation outright, his efforts are seen as an important part of changing public perception of the film from a cinematic triumph to one of the most racist pieces of propaganda in American history. But perhaps Trotter's greatest accomplishment has to do with more than just a movie.
He was pushing the civil rights movement in a direction called direct action. I mean, he was way ahead of his time. Trotter laid the first stone of the modern civil rights movement.
Today, this souvenir booklet on display at the Museum of the Moving Image recalls a controversial film and the brave man who fought to turn the page on racism. Marinette, Wisconsin. During the late 19th century, this lumber town sent freshly cut pine down the nearby Menominee River to Chicago and points beyond. And today, the legacy of the timber trade is on display at the Marinette County Historical Museum. It showcases an array of dioramas depicting the lumber industry, as well as tools and equipment from the area's logging camps. Yet there's one object here that speaks to a historic incident felt far beyond the Midwest.
The artifact is about 24 inches tall, cylindrical in shape, a little worse for wear, and it's got a round cover.
According to Associate Professor Daniel Calgren, this container represents a frantic search that stretched from Wisconsin to the White House.
This was easily one of the most bizarre disappearances that ever occurred to a presidential pet.
How is this milk can related to the strange story of an Oval Office cow? 1909, Washington, D.C. William Howard Taft has just been inaugurated as the 27th President of the United States. The 52-year-old Republican has a reputation as a deft administrator with a judicious mind. But he's also known for another notable characteristic.
William Howard Taft topped the scales at over 350 pounds. He was a very large man.
Taft has a voracious appetite for milk, butter, and cheese, so much so that the White House kitchen never seems to have enough. And rather than skim on his cream, the president makes an executive decision.
Taft felt the family needed to have a cow of their own.
When word of the president's request gets out, a Wisconsin senator named Isaac Stevenson answers the call.
Stevenson had a very prominent dairy farm and offered one of his cows to the Taft family.
Stevenson's prized cows are known for setting milk cans like this one at the Marinette County Historical Museum, overflowing with the smoothest, richest milk in the dairy state. And the cow he sends to Washington is no exception. Her name is Pauline Wayne.
She's immediately put out to pasture in the lawn surrounding the White House.
4-year-old Pauline produces an astonishing 8 gallons of milk a day, 25% more than the average cow, and more than enough to satisfy even President Taft. The first family is quite taken with its new pet, and they're not the only ones.
Pauline Wayne becomes a bit of a media darling at the time and immediately works her way into the hearts and minds of the residents in Washington, D.C.
Pauline is so popular that the White House soon receives requests for her to appear at events across the country. Yet Taft declines them all.
By all accounts, he liked to keep Pauline safe and sound close to the White House.
But in the fall of 1911, the president makes a rare exception. The organizers of a Wisconsin dairy expo ask for Pauline to take part in a special showcase. And as a favor to her former owner, Senator Stevenson, Taft agrees to lend the cow out.
This was a big deal because this would have been the first and only time that she was exhibited outside of Washington, D.C. during Taft's presidency.
On September 28th, Pauline Wayne is loaded onto a private cattle car attached to a train bound for Wisconsin. But when it arrives in Milwaukee a few days later, the cattle car is nowhere to be found, and neither is its valuable passenger.
No sign of Pauline Wayne.
When the news is wired to Washington, President Taft is incredulous.
The one time that he agreed to allow his family's cow to be taken out of Washington, D.C., she turns up missing.
For 2 days, railroad employees comb the country in search of Pauline Wayne. Finally, Taft gets a lead on her location.
Somehow she's ended up on the slaughter line down at the Union Stockyards in Chicago, the center of beef production in the United States.
The White House immediately contacts the stockyard. Finally, after a frantic search, Pauline Wayne is found.
She's safe and sound, much to the relief of, frankly, everyone involved.
But the question remains, how was Pauline Wayne lost in the first place? It seems that her private car was mistakenly hitched to a train loaded with beef cattle, bound for Illinois. Despite the mix-up, the White House cow makes her scheduled appearance in Wisconsin.
Pauline is the center of attraction by all accounts. She was a very popular exhibit.
After the expo, Pauline Wayne is returned to Washington, where she remains for the duration of William Howard Taft's presidency. And today, this milk can at the Marinette County Historical Museum in Wisconsin recalls the 1,500-pound pet who narrowly escaped the chopping block. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. This modest prairie town was founded on the banks of the Cedar River in 1838. Today, it boasts one of the world's largest corn processing industries, employing around 12,000 residents. And the fruits of their labor are honored here, at the History Center. Its collection includes an antique telephone switchboard, equipment from a 19th century grist mill, and a 1913 Maxon electric car, manufactured here in Cedar Rapids, one of just three ever made. But among these relics of technology is an artifact made by hand.
It's about 8 feet wide and probably close to 2.5 to 3 feet long. It's made out of burlap.
and it's attached to a wooden frame.
According to historian Mark Stopher Hunter, this paint-chipped sign once advertised a musical act that captivated the nation, but not for its talent.
This was an act that was incredibly watchable and unwatchable at the exact same time.
Who were the Cherry Sisters? And what was the secret of their success? 1893. It's America's Gilded Age, an era of dirty politicians, robber barons, and drunken excess. But in the farm town of Marion, Iowa, one family is ready to take a stand against these indecencies. Sisters Addie, Effie, and Jessie Cherry.
The Cherry Sisters were local girls who lived just outside the town limits. They never married.
The women believe America is in a state of moral decay. And one vice makes this clearer to them than any other. Vaudeville. These new variety shows are sweeping the nation and offer cheap and tawdry thrills to the masses.
There would be magic acts, comedic performers, burlesque. Sometimes animal acts were added to the program. Anything that would fill out an entire evening's worth of entertainment.
Addie, Effie, and Jessie deplore the filthy state of popular entertainment. And in 1893, they decide to fight this obscenity head-on by coming up with their own variety show.
They always felt that they were talented, and they wanted to come up with something completely original in the world of entertainment.
But unlike the acts that tour through town, their review will do more than entertain. It will enlighten.
They thought they would impart their own special brand of morality lessons in life.
Over the next months, the sisters worked tirelessly to create and rehearse their act, a distinctive mix of music and morals.
The name of their performance was Something Good, Something Sad.
The show is comprised of skits warning people about the dangers of evil temptations, like alcohol, loose women, even gypsy fortune tellers.
They truly felt that they could make the world a better place.
Finally, they make their grand debut. To the sisters, the audience seems delighted.
The Cherry Sisters are seeing smiles in the audience, and they're having a great time.
By the time the curtain drops, Addie, Effie, and Jessie feel certain they've found their life's calling.
They think they're great.
The Cherry Sisters perform Something Good, Something Sad to sold-out crowds across Iowa. But what the women don't realize is that audiences aren't coming for their talent or homilies.
People are coming to see them not because their act is good, but because their act is absolutely horrible.
The Cherry Sisters' singing is painfully off-key. Their dancing is terrible, and their monologues are utterly incomprehensible. The audiences are laughing at them, not with them.
It's almost like it was an American Idol of the 1890s. Is how bad can a performer possibly be?
But the sisters believe they are truly talented. And even when they hear the occasional jeer, they dismiss the criticism.
They would kind of brush it off and say, well, sometimes you have people that are disagreeable and they don't understand true art and you can't please everybody.
For the next 5 years, the Cherry Sisters travel the country, performing to standing room only crowds everywhere they go. Their act is advertised using signs like this one, now on display at the History Center in Cedar Rapids. But the Cherry Sisters are soon confronted with a critic too brutal to ignore. In March of 1898, a popular Iowa newspaper called the Des Moines Leader publishes a scathing review of the sister act.
They wrote that they sounded worse than wailing banshees out of Greek mythology, and nobody should have to be subjected to this performance anywhere at any time in the world.
The women feel the harsh critique is unfounded and fear it will hurt their future prospects. So they take decisive action and sue the newspaper for libel.
It was so cruel and so malicious in their view that they decided to make a legal case out of it.
But when the case is heard at an Iowa district court in 1901, the judge tells them that to issue a ruling, he must see the show for himself.
They actually had to perform in court.
The Cherry Sisters treat the judge to an exclusive engagement.
They did excerpts of their usual program, but they did it with even a little extra flair and a little extra finesse.
But when the judge issues his decision, it seems he wasn't impressed.
He decided then and there that there was validity to what the critics were saying, and the case was pretty much thrown out at that point.
In a landmark ruling, the judge declares that criticism of a public performance, no matter how malicious the review may be, is free speech and falls under the legal protection of the First Amendment. The verdict is later upheld by the Iowa Supreme Court. Devastated by the finding, the sisters eventually retire from touring and retreat to their Iowa farm. Yet their name remains a fixture in courtrooms and law libraries for generations to come, with the so-called right of fair comment rule still cited in courts to this day.
The case of the Cherry Sisters versus the Des Moines Leader set a whole new precedent in national libel lawsuit procedures in the United States.
And this sign at the History Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, survives as a tribute to the enterprising sisters, whose lack of talent never stopped them from stealing the show. From a superstar sleuth to slithering snails, a controversial film to canine cosmonauts.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.